everyone. Welcome to Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise Magazine's Passion Series Interviews. My name is Janet Atwood, and I'm the cover editor for Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise and author of The Passion Test, The Effortless Path to Discovering Your Destiny. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, this series is an opportunity for you to learn what you need to do to discover your passions and live your personal destiny by hearing from people who have been incredibly successful at doing that in their own lives. I like to begin these calls with a quote to remind us of the importance of passion, and I love this one from the 18th century French philosopher Diderot. Only passions, great passions, can elevate the soul to great things. I'm thrilled to introduce to all of you this evening to a great friend and a woman with one of the most beautiful hearts I know. Catherine Lanigan is a best-selling author of 35 books, including the novelizations of Romancing the Stone and Jewel of the Nile. Over 15 million of her books have been sold worldwide, and her books have been translated into dozens of languages. Her book, The Christmas Star, was selected Romance Book of the Year by Reader's Preference and received the Gold Award Romance Book of the Year from Forward Magazine. Catherine has also completed 9 screenplays and is CEO of Mountain Zen Productions. Mountain Zen is a film production company dedicated to the production of creative works that raise the soul, mind, and consciousness of spirit through powerful and enlightening stories. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Oh, thank you, Janet. This is so much fun.
I know, and the fact that you're a dog person even makes it better.
Oh, I know. I'm so serious a dog person. That's just...
I know. I love the fact that we fell in love over our golden retrievers.
Well, that's true.
Oh, what better way to begin a lifelong friendship. So, again, thank you.
Absolutely. Oh, you're welcome.
So let's get right into talking with you about your passions.
Okay.
What role has passion played in your life, and how have your passions... the things which are most important to you in your life contributed to your success?
First of all, I really, really believe that anyone who is in the creative arts especially, and, you know, I can't talk from all walks of life, I mean, none of us can, but I can certainly speak from this aspect, but if you're in the creative arts, you absolutely have to... you must access the passion that's in your heart in order to simply just sit down and do the work. It takes it just takes an incredible amount of courage, which is also, I believe it's also part of passion, to want to put on a canvas, you know, oils and acrylics and watercolors and things to create these visions that you have in your mind or in your soul and try and put them on paper, or to take, you know, little black dots and little lines and make music out of them because you hear something in your head, or to take words that are all jumbled up and, you know, give them symmetry and give them a song. And the courage to just sit down and do it takes a lot. I can't tell you how many times and how many places I've heard people say, oh, you know, I have this really great life. I have a great book inside me. I've been wanting to write a book for years. I've thought about it for 20 years, but they haven't sat down to do it. And that's where I think being the success, I think you're a success the moment that you actually sit down, start the work, and then the day you complete it, you're successful at that point. You don't have to have $1 billion for anything, but you have to be able to say you did it. And so for me, I think passion has also taught me persistence, to be honest, because every time I think that I'm done, then I wind up with another story I have to tell or another screenplay I've got to write, and I just keep going on and on and on. So it's an interesting path to take when you choose passion as your guide through your destiny path. I really believe that it is the thing that then guides you, and you don't have to make a lot of decisions. I think you make less decisions once you decide on that passion. I think you make less decisions because everything's cleared out of the way. You know, you just walk it. Sounds easy, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and we both know it's sometimes not. You know, you said in the very beginning that it takes great courage for people to follow their passions. So to know that, you have to have had that walk yourself. Mm-hmm. So where did courage come into your being able to follow your passions? What turning point?
That's a good question, because I was one of the lucky ones. I knew when I was 6 years old that I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be, remember the comic book Brenda Starr?
Yeah.
You know, in the newspapers, it was Brenda Starr, the reporter. I think it's still there, actually. Well, Brenda Starr, actually, this is a little fun trivia. She was invented by a woman who lived in South Bend, Indiana. And I grew up in La Porte, Indiana, and South Bend is where Notre Dame is. Well, anyway, she just died last year at the age of 98. But anyway, I wanted to be like Brenda Starr. I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be a writer. And I, all the way through high school, all my teachers said, yes, you write well. You should go for it. You should really try. And when I got into college, my freshman year in college, my writing professor, I got into a creative writing class. And after about the first month, we had to write a short story. So I wrote my short story, and then our whole thing was that we were supposed to put it in front of the class, and then the class would critique it. And I was the only freshman in this class that was second semester senior girls. Everybody else, they had all of their college career behind them. I mean, they had a wealth of knowledge that I had only begun to scratch the surface of. And anyway, the night before I was supposed to present my short story to the class, the professor called me to his office and said, I want to speak with you before we go to class on tomorrow night. And I said, okay. So I went over to his office, and he had my little, you know, I called a manuscript up. I'm sure it probably wasn't even 15 pages at the time. And he said, come in, Miss Lanigan, you know, sit down. And I did. And I just knew he was going to tell me how great my story was, because I had been primed for this all my life. I mean, every teacher, you know, how your parents always tell you, oh, that's great, honey.
Yeah.
And he said, frankly, Miss Lanigan, your writing stinks. I have no idea how you got into this classroom.
Oh, my God.
And I just sat there. I mean, I was so stunned. You know when you feel like, I mean, most people won't know that, but I felt like I'd been shot with a gun, you know? I just sat there. I mean, the blood just drained right out of me. I just sat there. I just said, what? And he said, you have absolutely no idea what characterization is. You have no idea how to plot anything. There are just thin threads here. Nothing becomes a tapestry. And, I mean, he just went on and on, just slamming this little story. I thought, you know, for 15 pages, this guy was able to critique a lot. And the only thing he said, I will give you, however, is the fact that your description is nice. That's the only good thing he could say about my writing. And I just burst into, I was 17 years old. I burst into tears. I said, I just don't understand. I've been writing things. You know, little stories, poems, everything, all the way through high school and junior high. I mean, I didn't do them when I was 8 years old, but I read when I was that young. And I said, I just don't understand. I want to be a writer. And he said, listen, you are a very fortunate young woman, because you have come to my class. And you are at the crossroads of your life. Your parents are spending a lot of money on this education, and there is no way, no way that you will ever earn a living as a writer. You need to get into another field of study, you know. And he said, you could be a nurse.
Oh, my God. And so what happened?
So the next day
you had to give your story. Did you do that?
So my passion, this passion I had since I was 6 years old, I was also very Catholic, and we were also taught to listen to the voice of authority, you know. So I believed him. I believed him. I changed my math. I changed from the School of Journalism and Creative Writing, and just said, okay, fine. If I can't write it, well, then I'll teach it. So I got I changed my majors to English and History, and then I had minors in philosophy, theology, psychology, French, anything else that they could give me. You know, I just was a bookaholic, so it didn't matter. And for 14 years, I didn't write a word. I mean, that was back when Jonathan Livingston Seagull was the big book of poetry, you know, and Richard Bach was everywhere, and And all my girlfriends were getting, poems published and short stories. I didn't do a thing. I taught school for a while, and I just said, I'm never, ever, ever going to believe in a dream. If I can't see it, taste it, chew it, spit it out, then it's not real, and I'm not going to believe in any of that kind of stuff. And that's what that was the decision I made that day. And then 14 years later, my son was, I was married, then I got married, and I had a son, obviously. My son was about 6 years old, I guess, and we were, the family was staying at the Four Seasons Hotel in San Antonio for a little vacation we were having. But that was when Judge Woods was assassinated by the Hell's Angels, and it was this huge trial and all kinds of, every journalist in the United States was in San Antonio, Texas, and most of them were staying at the Four Seasons Hotel back then. I mean everybody. Dan Rather was there, Walter Cronkite. I mean, it was unbelievable. I never saw so many journalists in my life. Well, anyway, there was by the pool, there was this group of directors and producers and cameramen and writers and everybody, and they were all sitting around talking, and I was not an assertive person at that time. I was only 30 years old or 31 or something like that. But I went up to this group of writers, and I said, I want to tell you that I really admire the work that you do being a journalist. I had always wanted to be a writer. And this one guy turned around, and he's, got a cigar in his mouth. I'm not kidding. I mean, it's like out of a movie, He's like, yeah, so you want to be a writer, eh? One of those things. I said, yes. And he said, well, then why aren't you writing? Very good comeback line. Always remember that. Why aren't you writing? And I said, well, I have it on good authority that I have no talent. And so why would I waste my life doing something that I have no talent for? And he said, who told you that? So I told him the story about the professor, and he said, I'm ashamed of you because you haven't even tried. He said, I've got friends that have manuscripts and screenplays stacked up from floor to ceiling, but they're in there and they're trying. They're really trying. They may not have gotten anything published, and they may never get their film, their film made, but at least they're trying, and you haven't done anything. And I thought, boy, you talk about the words to the, quick to my heart,
Oh, perfect.
Went home that weekend, and I thought about it all summer long, and I thought, so anyway, about 3 or 4 months later, he called and he said, I just sold my book to New York, and I was wondering if you had done any writing. And I said, no, and he said, you need to try. And I sat down that weekend, and I started writing. I came up, in 5 days, I came up with the plot line and the characters for a historical romance. And I sat down, to make a very long story short, I wrote about 400 pages in 3 months. Didn't even own a typewriter. I wrote it longhand in my son's first grade notebook on lined paper. I had my girlfriends, who had typewriters, type it up. I sent it to this writer. A month later, he calls me and he said, I got your manuscript. I read it. I thought it was damn good. And I sent it to my agent in New York City, and she's going to call you in half an hour.
Oh, that is so perfect.
I know. So this woman calls me from New York City, and she says, Kathy, you are startlingly talented. This is a far cry from, frankly, Miss Lanigan, your writing stinks.
Oh, God.
And I had not, and I kid you not, I had not written a single word other than some long letters to my mother because I couldn't afford phone calls at that time, long distance. I wrote long letters to my girlfriends. That's it. No stories, no poems, no, I'd never plotted a book. I didn't know the first thing about it. This agent says, I want to sign you with my company. I think you're a cross between Fred Mustard Stewart, who wrote Ellis Island at the time, which was historical, and Barbara Taylor Bradford. I think I can get you sold. I finished the book in another month, another 200 pages, and finished it in another month or so. Sent it to her. In 2 months, she had 2 publishing houses bidding on the book.
So bottom line, what was the lesson you learned from that whole experience that took you 14 years?
Well, the bottom line was...
Actually, it was 17 years, wasn't it? No, you were 17 years old, and it was 14 years later.
14 years later. The bottom line was is never to listen to anybody else when it comes to something that you're passionate about.
No matter what?
No matter what. You know what you're passionate about. Nobody else knows what your passion is, whatever it is. If it's a garden, if you're a gardener and somebody says, oh, you shouldn't be spending your time doing that, don't listen to them. You're here to do what your heart tells you to do on this planet. That's what I believe. That's what I learned. I lost 14 years. If you figure that I write a minimum of 2 books a year, that's 20. How many books is that? That's almost 30 books right there.
Well, you had to make up for lost time.
Yeah, I did. I still am.
So that's a great, great experience and a great story. So, someday you're going to have to write that one if you haven't already.
Yeah.
Because everyone, or so many of us have been there, with someone who said, who do you think you are and why do you
that's
think
right.
you're the one?
I think it's part of the human stain, whatever it is to always, is to knock other, we knock other people down. If their thinking or their desires are a little bit off from what ours are, we think that we're right and they're wrong. And that is wrong. First of all, to be intolerant. I mean, to be intolerant to someone and then to be judgmental is obviously wrong. But we all do it. Oh, what do you mean you're going to sell your house and go off and you're going to start this business or you're going to do... Well, you know what? If they lose their shirt, it's their shirt. It's not your shirt.
So how did that empower you? I mean, that changed your life, didn't it?
My 180 degrees. It totally changed my life. I mean, from that day forward, I have done nothing but read, write, research, write, research, write. I mean, it's disgusting, really, because I don't do anything else but write, or do something like, do you ever see that movie Tootsie?
Uh-huh.
And there's a part where Terry Garr says to Dustin Hoffman, she says, you see these glasses? I spent $20 on these glasses because I needed them to audition for this part. That's all I do is spend my money on things to audition for another part of something that I'm not going to get. I'm never going to make it. I'm never going to get there. I'm going back to Iowa. And that's kind of how I feel sometimes is I just spend all my time, all my money, everything, trying to come up with the next story that I'm going to do or to pitch it to one more person or to take it to one more studio. I'm tireless. I gotta say though, it just keeps me energized.
Well, yeah, and that's why you're tireless, because you're living your passions, wouldn't you say?
I am. I'm absolutely. I mean, I don't have. I'm very boring otherwise. I don't have any. I have no hobbies. I don't. Other
Catherine,
people go for.
You're the least boring woman I think.
So next.
Would you tell us the story of how Romancing the Stone and Jewel of the Nile came to be, and in particular, how your passions play a role in the creation of these books?
That's a very fun story, and unfortunately, it's a long one, too. But the bottom line is Michael Douglas was filming Romancing the Stone, July and August of 1983. And he decided they had very little money for advertising back in those days. Now it's, advertising budget for a film is almost what the budget is. Back then it was, $1 million. He didn't have much at all. So he thought his gimmick was, I'll have a novelization written by a romance writer about a romance writer. Makes sense, right?
Uh-huh.
So his representative went to my publishing house, which was Avon at the time, to the president of Avon at the time. And she was my editor. And she presented that. She said, "Look, here's the screenplay. We want to have a book written, a novelization of it, done as quickly as possible. And then, can you get it out by the first of the year? Because the film was coming out in April, and they wanted the book out in January." And my editor said, "Well, first of all, in order to do that, we only have one writer that can even write that fast." Because I took a 99-page screenplay and turned it into a 360-page book, and I had 28 days to do it in.
Okay.
That's
world record?
I think that's almost a world record. I mean, I know that Harold Robbins used to write a book in 6 weeks, but, he had somebody deliver his food to the door, and I still had to cook. So I get cooking time. But it was on a typewriter. It was still with correct tape. It wasn't on a computer. All that kind of thing, and there was no FedEx back then. You still had we had shipping blue label, which got something wherever it needed to be in 3 days. But that's the fastest you could do anything like that. Anyway, long story short, I got the book done in 28 days.
we had phenomenal reviews on the book and the work that I did, which was outstanding. And my passion comes in because my publisher at the time, the editor, I said to her, she said, I had just signed to do this huge book. I mean, huge. It took me 3 years to write it. It was called Sins of Omission. It had a tremendous amount of research, and it was one of the bigger books that I ever did. It spanned 50 years and three generations of two big families, all this kind of stuff. And I was doing Romancing the Stone and Jewel of the Now in the middle of writing Sins of Omission. But my editor said, I want you to do this because it's such a different kind of work, and it's going to teach you a lot about film and action and all that kind of thing. And my passion was to learn as much as I possibly could about my craft. And this was a reverse of my craft. And so I did it because I was overwhelmed with work. I was still working 7 days a week. No, 6 days a week at that time. 6 days a week at a swimming pool company. So I was still working days, and I was writing at night and on the weekends to get all of this work done. But I knew that if I did Romancing the Stone, I would learn something that in no way would I ever get that kind of education, crash course, so quickly. And then the fact that the film became, well, now, 20 years later, and so now we can say it is a classic, It was a fabulous experience, and I went on my gut because my agent said, now you don't have to do this. And I said, I want to read the screenplay, which I did, and when I read it, I fell in love with it. And I said, no, I'm going on my gut. I want to do it, which, you know, I still had to produce the other book as well. So that's how that happened.
Well, wait a minute. So you were working 6 days a week for a swimming pool company.
Right.
You were writing Sins of Omission, which was full-time, and...
Yeah.
You had to, in 28 days, write Romancing the Stone. Is that right?
Right. That's right.
And if it hadn't have been the love for your trade, no way.
There's no way.
There's no way.
I was fortunate in my job at the swimming pool company. It was not a busy job. I had a lot. I had a satellite store, and I was in sales. And if someone came in, I had to take care of them. For some reason, during those 3 weeks, I had a typewriter in the back of the room, and I spent probably about 5 hours out of my workday that I could work on Romancing the Stone. So that helped me out. But I literally slept maybe 2-3 hours a night, and then worked all weekend long on it as well, and then still doing my research and handing in what I needed to on the other book. So I learned then how to juggle two stories at the same time, keep my head in two different plots and two different sets of characters at the same time, because I had a year in 1997. I wrote four books in 1 year, and that's when I learned how to do it. But I learned it during Romancing the Stone.
This is so great, because we've done so many interviews, but I tell you, this is all new, and it's so wonderful because I know so many of our listeners are either writing a book or having that desire to write a book. And for all of you, you know, there's no such thing as obstacles when you're following your passion, because they just fall away. Would you agree?
Oh, I did. I absolutely do. I thought it was very funny. It's August, and I'm selling swimming pools in Houston, Texas. Now, that's a busy month, right? My store should have been filled to the brim with people. I swear, my boss wasn't happy about it, but, I mean, nobody walked in the door. It was weird. It was just weird. I mean, I get a few people in the early morning. The bulk of the middle part of the day was all mine. I got, you know, I was churning out page after page. I'd get a few towards the end of the day at 6 o'clock when, you know, and then I'd go home. And fortunately, I lived very close to my little condo at the time. And I was able to go home, take care of my son. And he was only a Cub Scouter, so what is that, 8 or 9 years old or whatever that is. And so he was in bed by 8 o'clock, and then I'd write until 2-3 in the morning.
Oh, forgive me, we forgot you also had a son to take care of.
Oh, yeah, and I had to take care of my son. And two cats,
no dogs. So, Catherine, you've published many novels which have been read by millions of people throughout the world. So
you know, I see with Romancing the Stone and Jewel on the Nile, during those days when you're writing Sins of Omission, there were obstacles, obviously.
Right.
Have you run into challenges, obstacles along the way with your other books, and what role did your passions play in helping you overcome those obstacles?
I had a book that came out by HCI a couple of years ago, a fiction called Wings of Destiny. And I started that book in 1987, and I did not get it published until 2001, I believe it was. I think it was 2001. And that book, of all the passions that I've had for stories that I mean, I'm passionate about every book. You have to be, otherwise you'd never get past page 10, you know. But Wings of Destiny spans like 250 years. The original manuscript was 1,200 pages. The research took me years and years and years. I must have made, I guess, about 8 trips. It's about the founding of San Francisco. And I made about 8 trips to San Francisco for the research. But the real passion came in is this. I could not get a publisher to buy it. And the reason for that is because it is a very racially charged book. And everyone considered it too hot to handle. But I was passionate about, my dad had a near-death experience, which you and I, Janet, have talked about that.
Right.
In 1987. And when he went to the other side, he came back and told me that the thing that he was told by the being of light was that all men, it's a different way that he says it. You have to read the book to. But all men are equal. We're all the same. We're all, you know, all races, all religions. Nobody's got the answer. We're just people. We're all souls. We're all part of God. We're all a piece of that fabulous creative mind, you know? And so I was raised that way, that everybody, you know, nobody is lesser than me and nobody's better than me. We're all the same. We're all loved by God. We're all God's children. That's just what I believe. So I wrote this book that has the hero is the son of a plantation owner and a voodoo priestess, but he is so Caucasian looking that everyone thinks that he is white, but he's actually a slave, and he escapes from the plantation when his father dies, the plantation owner dies, and he makes his way through the Underground Railroad in 1830, and gets to Boston and takes a whaling ship and goes down around in the Horn in South America and gets all the way to San Francisco, and he jumps ship once he gets to San Francisco, and he becomes a trapper and a trader, and then he gets a little land, and he winds up being one of the true founding fathers of San Francisco, but no one knows that he's an escaped slave. And it's the secret that he keeps all of his life. And so his granddaughter, this plot line goes on and on and on. But that passion, there's no way I could spend 15 years trying to bring, or 13 years or whatever it was, trying to bring one book to an entity, you know, to a book that's actually in a hardcover and bound and sold to people, if I hadn't believed in that story. I mean, I wrote 15 other books at the same time I was writing that one, but I never, ever, ever gave up. Because I wanted to make that statement. The only statement I was trying to make is that there were two statements, two underlying thematic structures in that book. One is that all men are created equal, and one is that God's retribution towards man is through natural disasters. And it ends with the earthquake in San Francisco in 1906. So
now, did you come up with that yourself?
Yes, ma'am.
No. Oh, very interesting. And why was that so important? This is a sidebar, but why was that so important, God's retribution to man?
Through natural disasters? Because...
why did you want people to know that?
Because I believe that that's where we're headed. I think with all of our global warming and with all of the pollution that we have strewn through our universe here on the Earth, our little earthly universe, that we're casting all of this junk physically onto the earth, but I also truly believe that negative energy that you create, your anger, your hatred, your malice towards men, your intolerance towards other men, I believe that it goes into the earth, and I think it erupts right back in your face. Sort of, you know, karma. You reap what you sow, that karma will come back and bite you, bud.
And now, this is really profound, though, and in 1987,
yes,
this was, I mean, this is so far ahead, Catherine. You know, there weren't a lot of people aware of environmental problems or challenges at that time. I mean, this is so ahead of the game.
Right.
And at that time, that was something that you wanted to, that you had a passion for, for addressing and getting out there.
And I believe that book was my destiny. I mean, I could not. There are certain books that I have that I know that I cannot pass from this earth without writing. They have to be written. I have one of them that's coming out, and you and I talked about it, Divine Nudges, is coming out in this month, actually, January and February, and Tales of Angelic Intervention. They're true stories of angelic intervention. I could not pass from this earth until that book was out there in the public. Those things that are in that book had to be said.
Now, your newest book, Divine Nudges, tell us what inspired you to write that book.
Part of it's one of my near-death experiences. I, as you know, about 4 years ago, I wrote Angel Watch, Goosebumps, Signs, Dreams, and Divine Nudges, and that was the first one. That one contained my father's near-death experience, where he told me that, and that was in 1987, when my dad had his near-death experience. Mine was in 1990 or 91. I honestly can't remember right now. I have to look at my own notes. And I was told almost the same thing that he was told, only mine was there was a whole lot more that went on in my near-death experience over and above what he had in his. But
What was it that you really wanted to communicate to people by writing that book?
That there is an interaction between our world, what we believe is the real world, and the unseen world, the world of the dead, that the dead angels, that our ancestors or our family members who have passed on are still alive. They're but just in a different form. They don't have our body, but they are still working with us, and we need to acknowledge them. We need to listen to them. And they can certainly give us very good guidance if we would only just open our minds and hearts to hear them.
Could you share with us a couple of stories which represent Divine Nudges?
Sure. Let's see. Oh, here's a good one, because I haven't told this story. Anyway, you're the first one to get a story, so this is the scoop, okay?
Okay, thank you. Hot off the press.
This is hot off the press. 3 years ago, in the summer of 2003, I guess it would be, 2003, I was living in Houston, where that's where you and I, you know, my house in Houston, and I got this phone call. There were a group of filmmakers trying to turn a book into film that were in Sedona, Arizona, and so the guy who was the head of the executive producer, he had been talking to me. He'd sent me his book. I read it. I said, yes, I could carve a screenplay out of it, all that kind of stuff. And we were in the process of negotiating fees and all that kind of thing. And then I met with several other people in his organization, but I had not met his producer, who was actually I would be working with to turn this book into film. And his name was Jed Nolan. And now Jed was 50-plus years old. He had never been married in his life, never proposed to anyone, never been engaged, ever, in his whole life, okay? So I'm in Houston, and he had left a message on my voicemail at home, and he said, my name is Jed Nolan. I will be the producer who is shepherding this, you know, book to film. I've heard a lot of really nice things about you from the other members of our company. I wanted to introduce myself, and when you get a chance, you know, give me a call back. This is my number. And, oh, by the way, will you marry me?
Oh, no.
Uh-huh. So I called him back, And I said, that's the most intriguing voicemail I've ever heard in my life. And I said, oh, and by the way, the answer is yes. Now, I never met this guy. I don't know anything about him. I have not talked to him or anything. Well, Jed and I have now been married 2 years on December 21st.
Okay, so...
So that's pretty much a divine nudge. When
everyone's gasping. Now, you got to tell us a little bit more, though, if there's got to be... I mean... Okay, so you both asked, he said, will you marry me? You said yes, and then?
And then we talked on the phone for about a month about the project. Then I came out to Scottsdale and Sedona here to meet with investors and meet the other people in the company and all that kind of thing. And the project really started moving forward. But we were still just a working relationship stuff, you know, type thing. But and then for months, then when I got really involved and started working on it, Jed really got involved. Then what's interesting is that as the project, the executive producer fired us both because he was losing control, he felt, of his project. And later we learned he was just a con artist and he's conning people out of money, so that part wasn't good. But Jed and I stayed together, and then we got, you know, a few more months after we worked together and got to know each other, we got a little more romantic and then a little more, and then 6 months later he proposed.
But here's the million-dollar question. When he said at the very beginning, and will you marry me, and you said yes, did either of you have any kind of intuition at all, like, you know, what was that, since there's no mistakes in the universe?
In fact, he says, I thought to myself, what in the world did I just say? I've never asked anyone to marry me. What am I doing? You know, and he hung up, and I thought, what am I doing? I don't even know this guy. You know, he could be like, you know, eh.
So he just was like, whoa, what was that, right?
Yeah, he did. It just came out of his mouth, and he was like, did I say that? What am I doing? Did I even say that? No, I didn't even say that. And then when I said yes, I thought, what am I doing? Why did I say that? It was almost as if the angels are speaking for us to get us moved on to the right path. Sometimes there's times when you say things and you think, did I just say that? And then it winds up being something that changed your life. That's a divine nudge.
So how do we all recognize divine nudges in our own life? And what would we need to look for? Because I mean, they're happening all the time, aren't they? If you were just awake to them, you'd notice?
Absolutely. They're happening all the time. When you kind of take a step back and, you know, you think, whoa, why did I do that? Why did I say that? Why am I? Or something seems a little oddball. You go to a meeting. You know, somebody invites you to a meeting, and you're going, I don't want to go to this meeting. I don't need to be in this meeting. But you go anyway. And once you get there, you can just feel. Think the energy is a little higher, the energy is a little bit better, the people you meet seem to be just a little bit more intriguing, or they may say things that are the words that you've been wanting to hear. I mean, now, there are many times when, you know, you don't want to just hear what you want to hear, you want to hear reality, but especially when you're looking for a sign or you need some guidance, you really need to pay attention. I've always had this one thing to give yourself a divine nudge. You can do this. Go to bed at night. You have this huge question you're trying to ask yourself. You ask your soul or ask your heart or ask your angels, however you want to say it. You ask them the question. Over the next 3 days, you listen for the answer. And out of three people that you meet, they can be best friends, total strangers, the guy at the gas station, you will hear the same sentence three times in a row within a three-day period or less. And that's your answer to your question that you asked your soul. I just had a friend today who called me from Houston and said, you know, I've been trying to decide what to do. I'm at that crossroads in my life. And he said, my daughter's moving to Prescott, Arizona. My business partner just moved to Scottsdale, Arizona. I'm thinking about moving to Scottsdale, Arizona. And I said, I think you're going to move to Scottsdale, Arizona. And he said, I need to make a change in my life. And I said, well, obviously you're ready. And he said, you're the third person in about 2 days that said you need to be moving to Scottsdale, you know, to Arizona anyway, Prescott, Scottsdale, Phoenix, whatever. So those are divine nudges.
Where did you come up with the three times in a row?
You know, that was told to me by a nun when I was in college.
And so you've always noticed that that's how it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I learned a lot. When I went to college, I went to a Catholic all-girls school. And I'm telling you, I learned more about astrology and reading palms and all kinds of things from the nuns I had than you can imagine. Very wise ladies, actually. But that's when I learned that, and I've used it all my life.
Do you believe that the divine is always active in our lives?
Yes. I think that I cannot imagine a life not believing that, because I wouldn't want that life. To think that, because the opposite of that is to think that you are in total control of your entire life, of everything that goes on in your life, and you know what? That's too much responsibility.
I hear you, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Why does
too much, you know,
go ahead.
I think today so many of us, I hear it all the time, I'm so overwhelmed. That's because you're carrying too much of a burden. We do have too much to do today. When I think how simple my life was 20 years ago, I can't believe it. And I was working, had a kid to raise, and writing two books at the, you know, at the same time.
Right.
That seems like a piece of cake compared to now.
So what do you tell people when they come to you and say, I'm so overwhelmed?
I tell them how to hand it over.
Tell everybody how to hand it over.
A lot of it is surrender to the, you have to be aware that there is divine going on in your life. And once you are aware, you can surrender it. And then it seems like the answer, not only do the answers come to you, but everything, all the guidance that you need comes to you. The right people seem to start walking into your life. The path seems a little bit clearer. I mean, no matter what it is, you know, when they always say the check is in the mail, suddenly the check is really in the mail. It just, the more and more it does help. The more you see it, you believe it. You know, they say, well, if I see it, I'll believe it. Well, the problem is it's going on and you're not seeing it.
You said you have to be aware that the divine is going on in your life. How about for those people that don't feel like anything's happening? Isn't there something that they could do to create more awareness around that?
I think there are.
How about ask? Would you think?
I agree. I think you have to. That's why, you know, when people say they spiral down and they finally get down to the bottom of the barrel, and then that's when they finally surrender.
And ask for help.
And they ask for help. And that's when they get it. Unfortunately, so many people, they have so little faith or so little belief that they have to go so far down. That's the whole basis of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Right.
Al-Anon, everything. It's when you finally are on your butt at the bottom of the barrel or the bottom of the well, and you finally hand it over for the divine to take care of for you. Isn't that amazing how everything just seems to come together?
So for those people that don't really have that belief, what I would suggest, what I hear you saying, is just to ask to know. You know, I mean, it's as simple as that. Like,
it is that simple.
I don't have that experience, so please instill in me the knowledge or the people, places, or things that I need to have in my life to realize that the divine is always working. And all
mm-hmm.
you have to do is ask, wouldn't you say, Catherine?
That's exactly right. You just ask. That's even as simple as that little thing I just told you, is if you have a serious question, I mean, it can't be something fluff, but a serious question, you ask the question at night before you go to bed, and you ask all the divine entities in your life, whether you believe in angels or not, it doesn't matter. Whether you believe in an afterlife, it doesn't matter. Just say, whatever the divine is, the creator of whatever, please answer my question in the next 3 days, and I will listen to strangers, I will listen to my family, and you will hear the same sentence or the same words out of three different people's mouths within 3 days or less. I now get the answer usually within about 5 or 6 hours, actually. I'm on a faster track than most. If I was 25 years old, it might take me 3 days, but I don't have time to wait around.
Hey. So, you know, another question that kind of goes with this conversation, why does it seem that terrible things sometimes happen to wonderful people?
I think that's exactly what we just got through saying, is that sometimes you have to get to the bottom of the barrel to surrender. And when you finally hand it over to God or to the divine or whatever you want to call it, you know, when you finally say, I can't do this anymore, you're just going to have to handle it. I can't. I am not Superwoman. I am not Superman. I'm just a man. I'm just a woman. I'm just a soul on this earth. Please help me. That's the day that it all starts happening, and you get a lot of help. That's why.
So in your book, Divine Nudges, what, will you just go over quickly, what inspired you again to write that book?
My near-death experience. This is the second in a series of angel stories. And my near-death experience was 15 plus years ago now, maybe 16 years ago now. And I have not had the courage to write about that near-death experience all this time. And this, and I finally, I mean, I've, for this book, I feel I pushed the envelope because I tell a lot about what I saw. On the other side, I saw a crystal kingdom or a crystal city, whatever you want to call it. I call it the crystal city. I saw my parents, and my father had not died at this time, but I was told he was going to die within a year, and he did. I was told my mother would live quite a bit longer. She's now 86. At the time, she's only 70-something.
So in writing about your near-death experience, what was the bottom line message that you really wanted the world to hear?
Honestly, that there is an afterlife. There is another life after this. And I did not, I have, you know, I was raised a Catholic, and I have always believed that there was an afterlife. I've seen an afterlife since I was a tiny child. I've been talking to angels for so long, I thought everybody did. And about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, I walked into a place that's here in Scottsdale, and a friend of mine is there. She works there, owns it. And she said to me, I had given her a copy of Angel Watch, my first book, and she said, you know, Catherine, do you really honestly believe that there is a life after this one? And I was so taken aback, I thought, oh, my God, I've known this lady, and I think the world of her, and she's a very spiritual person. She's really into holistic healing and all this kind of stuff, and she's not sure that there's an afterlife? I need to tell people that there is one. I saw it. I was there. I was there quite a while, actually. And there's a lot going on over there.
And that's so they won't be afraid about death?
Yes. So they will not be afraid of death, so that they will know that there is something else, so that they will know that when they see their dead Uncle Harry show up on their, when they are dying or before that, or if they see an angel or they have something mysterious happen, they don't say, oh, that was just my imagination, and make it go away. Or they try to use science or something else to explain away all these miracles that are actually happening in their life. That's what's been our problem for the last 20 years, or maybe 2,000 or 10,000, is we so easily want to only believe what is here, what we can touch, and what we can feel, and what we can see, and what we can taste. When my father was dying, he said, you see this world around you. He was in a hospital room. He said, you see this room? He said, you think that that's reality. He said, it's not. This world that you are living in is the dream. The world on the other side, that's reality. This human life is only a dream.
Now, you've written 35 books and screenplays and who knows what else. And of all of them, would you say that these books, the ones that were your passion, were the ones with the message? Or did they all have a message?
They all have a message. The first thing I was going to say is every one of my books has a message. Even the you know, the slightest little romance, I have always believed that leaving a legacy of love can't be all bad.
And so when
every
you
time I write about love, it's what all of the great masters came here to teach us, is to love one another.
So would you say that one of your passions obviously is leaving a legacy of love, and that's why you've been so successful as a novelist.
I believe that, yes, absolutely.
Well, that's,
absolutely.
That is so beautiful. Yeah, because your passion's always with you.
Yeah. It just, it never goes away. It, I never get, and I certainly never get tired of it. I mean, it's constantly knocking at my door saying, get up, let's write another one, you know.
So would you say that's your secret in writing a great romance novel?
Oh, yeah. There, well, yes. First of all, you have to have the passion for it, but there are other things that just come as far as the skill and everything. But the underlying thing that makes a great romance novel or a great novel of any kind are the characters. The characters, the characters, the characters. Nobody really cares what they go through. They care about how they grow and who they are. In order for you to have fabulous, memorable, haunting characters, you have to feel their life essence in your own heart. And without your own passion, you cannot infuse them with passion. Otherwise, their life would be just as flat as your life would be. So who wants that?
And what are the elements of a successful romance novel?
Well, it depends upon how you define successful. I define successful in the fact that it touches the hearts of my readers. I care more about my readers than I care about anything. And I've had good reviews. I've had incredible reviews. I've won awards, and I've had really rotten reviews. But none of that stops me. I've had books that have made lots of money. I've had books that haven't made a dime. But it is... Sorry about that. But it is the success of knowing when I go to a book signing and that reader comes up and she's got that book that's all doctored and she said, you have no idea how this book touched me. I've gotten letters from readers that have read my novels and have literally changed their life because the heroine was so strong that she, A, broke away from an abusive husband, she got the job she always wanted, because my heroines pursue their passions. And so that's how I'm able to know that my books are successful, is because my readers tell me that.
So what advice would you give our listeners who are inspired to become fiction writers?
Well, sit down and write the book. That's the first thing I'm going to tell you, and that's the hardest thing to do.
You know, years ago when you and I first met, I got on the phone to you, and I said, you know, what do you tell people when they're afraid to, you know, to write? And you went, do it! I will never forget that.
Yes.
You screamed into the phone, do it!
Do it.
That's so great.
It is, and it's just, you just have to do it. And it's interesting because in September this year, it's the first time I've ever done this, is I have a book, a how-to book, coming out from Allworth Press called Writing the Great American Romance Novel. And I wrote it as a legacy for my granddaughter, who is only 7 years old. But I thought, you know, I'm not getting any younger, but if something were to happen and I were not, I died or I was in a foreign country or something, or she couldn't get to me and ask me, and if she came to me and said, Grandma, I want to write a romance novel, I want to be like you, I wanted to put down on paper everything that I would tell her to make her path easier for her. Because I lived through all these different experiences and high roads, low roads, awful ones, great ones, tragic ones, all this stuff. And I want her to, this is what I learned. I mean, there's $1 billion worth of experience in that book. And unless you live it, there's no way you can learn it. And I wanted to put in it anecdotes and things that other writers, you know, usually the books like that are so boring. I mean, after reading a book on how to write a book, it's like, oh, who cares? I don't even want to do this. So I at least know that the book is not boring.
Now, it helped ever, and I can't see that you could ever put anything out that would, and I can't wait for everyone to get to meet you in person because you're just a raging, outrageous, flashy, colorful, lively, bottom-lined Texan, and I love you. So.
Thank you.
Now, Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise believes strongly in the power of intention to manifest outcomes, which I know you do too as well.
Oh, yeah.
What is your biggest current project, And what intention would you like us, along with our readers and listeners, to hold for you?
You know, boy, is that a hard question, because I have literally 9 screenplays that our company, Mountains End Productions, which, by the way, you can get at my website, www.katherinelanigan.com. I want to get my books made into film. I have like 3 or 4 Christmas ones right now. Christmas Star, Daddy Loves Santa, Miracles Are Golden. All of those Legend Makers I want to see into, you know, the big screen. Wings of Destiny would be a fabulous miniseries. I'm working very, very hard to bring Angel Watch and Divine Nudges to a weekly television series where we show the angels that people saw. Now that we have computer graphics, everybody's angel that they see is not the same thing as the next guy's. And I want to be able to, you know, put that on television so people can see this. So those are some really big projects. We're meeting with some people coming up next week where I have a book, Mr. Romantica, to be taken to hardcover, softcover, and film. I really want that project.
So novels to film and TV.
Yeah.
With that kind of bottom line.
TV. Yes, that's it.
So all our listeners, for Catherine, for the great gift of her being on with us today, let's intention for her novels going to film and TV. So single idea would you like to leave our listeners with tonight? You have about 1 minute to share, so go for it.
Pretty much what we've said, but, you know, I really believe that we all instinctively know why we are on this earth. And whatever it is that you do, it doesn't matter what it is. Go for it. Do it. Embrace your life with passion. Take chances. Take risks. And so that when you go to your deathbed, you know you made some mistakes. Who cares, you know? But you will have no regrets. That's the big thing, is you don't want to be dying and say, gee, I wish I would have.
So go, in other words, go for it and do it, right?
Do it.
So for all of you that are listening, to find out more about Catherine Lanigan, go to www.catherine, that's with a C, A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E, Lanigan, LANIGAN.com. Catherine, thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome, Janet.
I just adore you, and you've reminded us that divine is always with us and caring for us no matter what's going on, and we all need that reminder, and, you know, we can't get it too much. So thank you for bringing us back to the divine, Catherine, truly.
Oh, you're most welcome, and you have a very blessed week.
Oh, thank you. And for our listeners who would like to get a copy of Divine Nudges, you can purchase it from Amazon.com. And again, to learn about Catherine's other books, go to www.catherinelanigan.com, CatherineLanigan.com. As always, we have some extraordinary interviews coming up for you. Mark Victor Hansen will interview Dr. Wayne Dyer, the father of motivation, on January 10th. On January 24th, we interview Dr. Ivan Meisner, one of the world's leading experts in networking and word-of-mouth marketing. Dr. Meisner is the founder of BNI Business Networks International, the world's largest referral organization with over 80,000 members and more than 4,000 chapters around the world. On February 7, we interview award-winning speaker Les Brown, and on February 21, the co-author and a great friend of mine of all the Chicken Soup for the Woman's Soul and Mother's Soul books, Jennifer Hawthorne, will be our guest. So be sure to join us in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, remember your passions are your clues to your unique destiny. Choose in favor of your passions every day, and you will find yourself living a passionate, turned-on life. So, Catherine, again, thank you with all of our hearts. And we're going to open up our lines and say goodnight. Good night, everyone.
Thank you.
Good night. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.